So when you're dealing with institutions, and keep in mind that institutions really are the ones that have the big pools of capital that can move the market tremendously, as we believe that they will do so, they would need to have the confidence in the transaction.
Welcome to a Bit Cryptic Podcast, where we interview top crypto experts to take you down the rabbit hole into the world of cryptocurrency. Now, it's time to get a bit cryptic.
Hey, Cryptonauts, this is Jeff Peterson, and I'm with my co-host today,
Alain Leon, aka Bitcoin Van Gogh.
I feel like I need to come up with a cool name like that, Bitcoin Van Gogh.
Nothing is that cool.
I don't think we'll ever get as close as Bitcoin Van Gogh. And we are here with a very special guest, Eli Javad Ansari. He is head of blockchain investment banking at Bousted Securities. He has over 22 years, almost 23 years of global investment experience. So today we're going to be diving into his vast knowledge in that space, and he can teach us a little bit about how he picks them. So we are very excited to have you today, Eli.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, guys. Appreciate the opportunity.
Not good to have you.
So just before we started the recording button, we were having a really interesting conversation that I want to circle back on that has nothing to do with crypto, but I feel like is useful for every single person listening. It's about traveling and sleep. So what were you saying earlier, Alain, about what you had heard from the podcast you were listening to?
Yeah, so Eli, you know, we were chatting and he was talking about, you know, he's on the other side of the world, essentially, and how much he's traveled from one place to another. And I mentioned to him about a podcast that I enjoy a lot. It's called Kevin Rose. And for all our listeners who are not aware of it, you should definitely go take a listen. And one of his latest episodes, he was talking to Professor, I believe his name was Walter Longo, a world-renowned expert in sleep. And he just completely blew my mind about how important sleep is. But he also had a little bit of a 5-minute spiel of what you can do when you're traveling from one place to another, sort of to get your body ready and not have it be a big shock. So I thought Eli perhaps could take something from that. So I recommended it to him.
I appreciate that. Definitely will check it out.
Yeah, because Eli, so those of you who aren't either of us three on this podcast recording right now, so Alain and I are in Miami and Eli is in Beijing. So it's 8 p.m. here and it's 8 a.m. over there. So Eli, you said you were like traveling now back to Korea. You're currently in Beijing and your lifestyle is basically just traveling nonstop.
Yeah, it's a pretty much decentralized living in the world of blockchain.
You're taking it to a whole new extreme.
Yeah. Been in Hong Kong, Japan, now in Beijing, and then heading over to Korea, and then back to Hong Kong. So pretty much a lot of Asia travels.
Yeah, and I would say that's not unusual for a lot of folks in the blockchain business, because blockchain is right now is truly an international game.
Indeed.
And lots of things happening all over the world, lots of conferences, lots of businesses, lots of new things all over the world having to do with blockchain.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole world blockchain is global, as you said. And, you know, the conferences are a perfect venue and occasion to kind of have the international community meet the local blockchain community, exchange ideas, work on great projects and compare notes and just increase the size of the community, welcoming new people. So it's just a great experience. And the conferences are all over the world from, you know, I was in Europe the month of June from Money 2020 in Amsterdam, which is, you know, historically not a blockchain conference, but had really big blockchain element in it. Because as you know, the traditional financial institutions are finding ways to get into the blockchain. So it was very, very useful to London alternative blockchain investment, and there, London is just one of the hotbeds of blockchain and just immense number of conferences. So agreed.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I would add, can they afford not to pay attention to blockchain anymore? I mean, when you have companies like Binance announcing that they're making $300 million, you know, in a quarter, and Coinbase making so much money, I think that starts to raise some eyebrows and gets people interested.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Binance is an outlier in terms of the revenues, but even traditional exchanges and a lot of other businesses are reporting really healthy growth. And that's why we believe that this is just the beginning of it. And I think some of the things we'll talk about is really the institutionalization of blockchain and the formation of additional institutional funds. That's going to require more institutional versions of exchanges and the support. And just, you know, we haven't really seen the Moody's version of services in the blockchain yet. So I think this is just a starting point.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this industry develops. We're still very much in the early adopter stage. And I mean, everyone sees those graphs of like when you hit the hump of the mainstream world in, what do you call it, adapting a new technology. And it's going to be crazy to see like what happens when we hit that point.
Exactly.
So I want to dig into a little more about you, Eli, because I think it tells more about what got you to where you are today and makes your story a little more interesting. So could you tell us more about your background?
Yeah. So, you know, my background is over, you know, multiple decades, I would say. So my background is over 22 years in investments and investment banking, from investment management and investment banking to backing successful companies in the startup space. But, you know, primarily it's been investment management and investment banking. We've been very involved in the game industry investment banking from 2008 onwards. And that's really what got us to where we are. As you know, the digital assets and blockchain is sort of the next iteration of the movement that started in the game industry, from virtual currencies to really creating the different digital assets that we see now, and then the underlying technology, which is the blockchain. So we've been involved in the regulatory framework for many, many years. We are FINRA SEC registered broker dealer. So I'm a registered representative of Bowstead Securities and the head of blockchain investment banking, which is a FINRA and SEC registered broker dealer. And one of the reasons we really came into the space of blockchain in 2017, late 2016, is basically we saw that the blockchain is at a stage where there's an opportunity to be regulated, and there's an opportunity for an oversight. And we saw the actions from SEC and FINRA and global regulatory bodies, and we believe that the timing was right to be involved in the industry and really bring in our regulatory framework and regulatory licenses to be able to help increase the industry and really make it more institutionalized. As you know, the industry was started however it was started, but we're seeing, you know, really, really high-level figures like Mike Novogratz coming into the industry. And these guys have tremendous institutional pedigree. And we believe that having a broker-dealer involved and having a registered investment bank involved in assisting companies with their capital formation is needed. And we believe that more and more banks are going to come into the space. And we've been involved with several really good opportunities through their life cycle. And we believe that this is just the starting point, and we'll see more and more of the institutions coming in the marketplace.
So just to back up a second for the guests who maybe aren't so well-versed in a lot of this terminology, starting at the basics, what is a broker-dealer? What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so broker-dealer is a regulated entity. In the U.S., it is regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And the purpose behind that is to engage in transactions where the acting as a broker, the firm can be compensated by success. So the amount of commissions that are being generated in a transaction like a capital formation, capital raising, or mergers and acquisition is a regulated activity, which means that the commissions are can only be earned if you are a registered broker-dealer. And the same thing goes with a merger or acquisition. The compensation, which is in the form of a commission, as we call it, success-based fee, can only be earned if you are a broker-dealer or you're registered with a broker-dealer. So those are the activities the broker-dealer license allows you to conduct.
Eli, this is a space where there's a lot of libertarians originally, a lot of anarchists, a lot of people that are of the opinion that you shouldn't really have all these regulations and all the Security and Exchange Commission involved, and they're not happy about this development. But earlier on, you said that this is needed, I think was the word you used, in a sense to if we want institutions to come in and invest in the crypto space, that essentially broker-dealers and companies like yours are needed to offer, in a sense, legitimacy to the space. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think you use the right terminology. The legitimacy is the key word. So when you're dealing with institutions, and keep in mind that institutions really are the ones that have the big pools of capital that can move the market tremendously, as we believe that they will do so, they would need to have the confidence in the transaction. The blockchain is quite a new industry. You know, you can't really look at a project and say these guys have done three blockchain projects before, right? I mean, this is so new. Most of the teams are built over people meeting at conferences. You know, third conference, they're our team now. So I think this is great, but definitely we will see more and more institutions coming in as well. And that's going to require more institutionalized practices, because these guys have been ingrained in that methodology for years and years and, well, decades and sometimes centuries. So, you know, we can't really comment on how people use the word anarchist. But I think from our perspective, we are in the industry, and we our goal is to help grow the industry and bring in institutional capital in the industry and help expand the footprint of the industry by bringing in our regulatory stack in the industry and really making the industry more legitimate. So I think we play a very different role in terms of helping the companies do compliant offerings. They're compliant with the Securities and Exchange Commission rules and regulations. And that's what we focus on. And our goal is to have other broker dealers come in as well. And, you know, we sort of are in active dialogues with other ones as well. And, you know, we're a source of just, you know, any questions they may have and any opportunities they see, we're there to help them guide through the process. But overall, our belief is that this is something that's needed.
How does that differ from, say, what a law firm might be doing for helping? Because a lot of companies will hire a law firm to get SEC compliance. How are you doing that as a broker firm?
So SEC creates the rules and regulations. The law firms creates the documents and allows them to actually initiate an offering. Somebody still has to conduct the offering in terms of how the offering is actually structured, how it is implemented. So from KYC, AML, PEP, which is Know Your Client, anti-money laundering, and several different other levels where you would have to vet and ensure that the investor coming in is actually suited for the investment, one. Number two is legitimate so that you can take the capital from the investor and being able to do the offering in a compliant fashion. So we work very closely with the law firm. Law firm structures a deal. We actually conduct the offering.
Now, quick question. You said you're a broker-dealer. How long has your company been a broker-dealer, more or less? Is it relatively new? Have you been in...
Yeah, so we are coming in from a traditional investment banking background, and the firm has been a broker-dealer in the U.S. Since 2006.
Okay.
And so I would say about a dozen years.
You have a good bit of experience. I ask because I was surprised. I was surprised myself when I found out that Coinbase themselves, I mean, they were looking either to acquire a company that was a broker dealer or they may have recently just become a broker dealer. But I was surprised myself that they weren't already one, you know, that an exchange as big as Coinbase themselves wasn't a broker dealer.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the interesting component you will see. So we are coming in from a broker-dealer world that is regulated. And like you said, I mean, we've been a broker-dealer for a dozen plus years now. And we believe that this is where the industry is going to go. You saw that exactly with Coinbase acquiring a broker-dealer shop to get in the space. And on a weekly basis, I get inquiries from other firms trying to join our broker dealers because they know that the rules and regulations are coming. They can see the writing on the wall. And if, you know, pretty much if you have to do business in the US, you have to be a broker dealer or be registered with a broker dealer.
I see. So this is like, you've got the document makers, you've got the regulators, the SEC, and you guys are the ones who execute.
Yeah, we are. Essentially. Yeah, exactly. So in terms of actually conducting the offering within the regulated framework, that's what we do. And when SEC comes in, FINRA comes in, so we basically have to show them all of the processes and procedures being followed for that offering.
Interesting stuff. I'm learning something.
Trust me, it is quite a bit of work in terms of the rules and regulations. But again, that's really what we bring to the table in terms of the regulatory clarity on the compliance. And institutional investors want it.
I want to focus now a little bit more on the average investor. I mean, we talked about institutional investors. It's important to bring regulations so they can feel more comfortable and start investing, you know, lots of money without worrying about where it goes. What about the average investor, say someone who has a few $1,000s that they're trying to put into cryptocurrency? What are some of the implications of what's happening in the cryptocurrency space right now? And what advice would you give to them?
You know, I can't give any legal advice or any investment advice. Well,
right.
I can't give
and everything we say on this podcast is not investment advice, guys. Anyone
absolutely
listening?
Not. Yeah, we say that every single podcast.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Thank you. I think from my perspective, the way we look at it is at a general level is be very careful. Just because it has done well doesn't mean that it will continue to do well. I think, you know, to 2017, a lot of, you know, individuals, from what I've heard, made really good returns, which is great. But we also know that past performance is no indication of future returns. But nevertheless, it is an industry that is growing. It has higher opportunities. It has bigger opportunities and higher alpha than we would know in some other industries. So I would look at it and say, if you are going to invest as an individual into a project, make sure it is a compliant offering, meaning that they're not breaking any rules and regulations of the jurisdiction, and understand the teams and try to do your homework. Understand, read the PPM, which stands for the Private Placement Memorandum or an Offering Memorandum, and see if it is led by a broker dealer. Look up the broker dealers, and if it is led by somebody else, then understand, you know, how are they getting compensated. So I think what I would recommend is do your homework as an individual. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, $1,500, regardless of the amount, have to do your homework and understand that the offering is done in a compliant fashion. And then, of course, understand the actual merits of the investment. So from a technology perspective, from understanding the overall market they're in, you know, just standard investment due diligence.
Now, Eli, you mentioned that, you know, something that in a way we all know, right? That because something has done well in the past, it does not mean that it's going to continue to do well in the future. But you also said that it is a young industry and that it's growing. Now, I want to mix that with a name that you threw, that you talked about earlier while we were talking, and it's Mike Novogratz. And Mike Novogratz is, you know, the billionaire hedge fund manager turned crypto evangelist, very, very famous in the crypto space. He keeps saying that, you know, the herd is coming, the herd is coming, essentially referring to the massive pent demand, potential hundreds of millions, maybe trillions of dollars from Wall Street institutions, and what they require for that money to be placed into the space, and we see a number of exchanges making moves to accommodate those needs. Do you foresee this happening, this growing, this investment coming in the future, just generally, personally, not investment advice?
Sure, no, I appreciate that. We definitely do. We believe strongly in the upcoming, what we call as the institutionalization of the blockchain, the digital asset. As earlier we said, the regulatory framework is very important. As the regulatory framework is getting clearer, and the ability for these institutions to trade and hold these assets, for example, the custody solutions, the institutional grade storage, you know, we're seeing more and more institutions allocating part of their assets under management, called AUM, to digital and blockchain opportunities. You know, I met with several institutions in Asia, and these guys are all traditional institutional asset managers, and they're starting their new funds for blockchain opportunities. So we advise them in terms of, you know, how traditionally the life of the fund should be in terms of, you know, when we are seeing it. But of course, that is, you know, purely as a friendly advice. But we definitely see quite a bit of interest coming in from institutional investors.
Now, when you say fund, what are you referring to? Are you referring to, because, you know, that word in regular lingo has a meaning, or are you talking about a basket of currencies, or what are we talking about here?
Yeah, so most of these funds are the private equity, venture capital, hedge fund type funds that are structured as a fund. And what they do is engage in investing in different asset classes for whatever they are, they have the mandate to do so. So the fund is, you know, a typical venture capital, private equity, or hedge fund.
So you mentioned you give advice to both companies that are creating funds, but also you give advice just to crypto companies generally. I want to know, what are some of the things that you see crypto companies often make mistakes with? What's something that crypto companies are often getting wrong, in your opinion?
Yeah, so I think the companies that we see in this space, and we're at a lot of conferences, as we discussed the, you know, earlier about these sleep issues. we meet with a lot of projects.
Yeah, I'm going to one in 2 days, so I'm right there with you.
I think what we see is how they structure the project, you know, the regulatory framework selection, how the just overall the adherence to the framework. By framework, I mean the regulatory framework. And that's one part of it. And we see a lot of projects not having the appropriate counsel. So I think, you know, earlier you mentioned about the counsel. The reality is that a lot of the counsels are new to the space, and they're learning as well. So we've seen a lot of some issues there. So we
have a friend who's a compliance expert, and he said he'll give talks and literally ask the audience, you know, who here is a lawyer, and then ask someone to give their opinion, and then he'll ask another lawyer their opinion, and they'll be exactly opposite. And he's like, so it looks like you got a 50-50 chance if you pick a lawyer on what you're going to get, either a right answer or a wrong answer, or maybe both are wrong.
Exactly. You know, we make a joke is that, you know, if you ask 5 lawyers how many opinions you get, the answer is 12, because not only they'll be different, they'll change their opinion too.
So well, absolutely. Shit.
So that's one part.
And you paid
of
all
it.
Of them too. That's the best part.
Yeah. And you gotta, and exactly. And I won't even go there. But yeah, that's exactly how we see it. And then I think the other problem that we see it is that we have seen some projects, and we have heard through the grapevine some projects that really are not fair to their advisors, and some cases to their investors. You know, advisors are very important. They're the ones that really help the project get to the point where it is. And you know it's a very small industry, so you know, delivering on the commitments is very strong. It's very important. It sends a very strong signal. So I think that is.
Could you give some examples without naming any names? Like, you don't have to say specifically what happened, but kind of generally, I'm curious.
I think a lot of times what happens is that people sign up advisors and they deliver basically the compensation, whatever they promise they will. I have heard of instances where, you know, the advisors basically were signed up and their likeness was used, but they were never compensated.
Hmm.
You know, there are so many projects
going on. Or they changed the deal or...
Exactly. Changed the deal. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times I wouldn't say a lot of times. A few times I've heard that they were advised, especially the high-profile advisors being used as an advisor in a project that they never even heard of. Right. I mean, those are the instances that are getting less and less is because, you know, more and more people getting to know the advisors and, you know,
people are getting savvy that this thing happens too.
Exactly. So the advisors, the top 20 advisors in this space are getting more and more well-known. People know them. So when there's an opportunity that an investor sees, they are able to get a hold of that advisor and personally ask them, is like, hey, I saw you as an advisor in this project, are you involved, right? And then the advisor can say yes or no, or like, wow, let me check.
You know, I have seen some advisors that advise so many projects that I would not be surprised if they're like, oh yeah, I forgot I advised that thing.
I know. That's the flip side of the coin.
It can be very lucrative for some of those. I mean, people will get paid anywhere from like 20 to 500K just for being an advisor. So I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, it's a full-time business, even like just advising a bunch of projects.
You know, we don't know the other side of the equation, but I'm sure that, you know, the way that these guys are, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. I mean, well, for example, I get offered to be an advisor on multiple projects as well, because I was part of the B Token marketing team, and you know, we had a very successful token raise and all that. And so I most people on our team like get hit up multiple times a day. So it's kind of, and I'm sure you guys do as well. And once you're in more of your main exchange launching phase, it'll probably be just a torrent of people asking you every day, especially once it's successful.
Yeah.
So it can be a bit of a nuisance, actually.
Yeah. No, congratulations. Yeah,
oh, thank you.
That was a good project.
Yeah. Now we just got to keep delivering. So I wanted to know a little bit about how you guys are involved in crypto beyond advising projects. You're an investment bank. So do you guys actually do investment into crypto, like into projects or exchanging or buying currencies and using it on exchanges or anything like that?
So we're not trading digital assets at the investment bank. We help blockchain projects access capital in regulated and compliant offerings. So we have plans to launch the exchange for security tokens in the very near future, and we're actively working on it. And I can tell you that the custody is a big component. There are only a few solutions that we like, but for our institutional level exchange, we would like to see more institutional grade custodians of digital assets. But you know, they're coming, and we have been very actively involved in, you know, creating our own solutions as well. So yeah, I completely agree with that.
No, when you say institutional level custodial services, what does that mean exactly, and how does that differentiate from what we have now, like from using Binance, for example?
Yeah, so Binance is an exchange that where you should not be keeping all your digital assets, right? Because you have to have cold storage where it's offline, right? And unless until, so you should keep only the, again, not an investment advice, but you should only keep the actively traded assets on an exchange. Otherwise, you should keep it in cold storage offline. So that's not prone to hacks or anything along those lines. But if you're an individual, then you don't really need to have an institutional grade storage or custody solution. But if you're an institution where you have several partners in the firm, you have multiple levels, then can you trust just one partner to hold the assets that the entire firm depends on? So the institutional grade storage requires several different levels of signatures and ability to hold it in a place where the firm as a whole can protect its assets. And keep in mind, they have fiduciary duties to their clients or their investors. So it has to be at the same level where it can be a multi-signature, but not only just two signatures, but multiple signatures and the set of protocols that can protect an institutional grade holding of digital assets.
And you said you're working on an institutional level
security token exchange, solution. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I wanted to dig more into that, like how, because I haven't heard of an exchange being able to trade security tokens yet. So would you guys be the first or one of the first?
You know, I think we would be probably one of the first ones. We probably would not want to be the first one. I think this is a space
where...
you get
a big target on your back.
Exactly. I mean, there are some projects that are doing a really good job of becoming one of the first ones, and we work with them. We're friends, and we back them. Even the companies that we underwrite, if they, you know, come out first, we would love to trade, list our product, our projects on those exchanges. But the reality is that it's going to be a big market. I mean, we're talking about a market of $10 trillion, theoretically, in digital assets that are going to be on security token exchanges. And we believe there are going to be several out there. We believe that eventually there'll be consolidation, but at least in the next few years, there'll be several solutions out there, and they are going to compete. So we're really looking forward to it. You know, our solution is purely institutional grade, and we're looking at really providing institutional grade service. Just if you just add up the number of times we have used institutions on this podcast, that's basically
drink for every time, guys.
Yeah, exactly.
It's important. A lot of, you know, this talk is being had in a lot of chats and a lot of rooms because everybody is saying that, you know, and Mike Novogratz, just to mention his name again, you know, he's been saying it for years that the herd is coming.
Yeah.
And in a way, people are almost expecting it, especially now that, you know, the crypto markets have taken such a tumble. For some people, it seems like, oh my God, you know, this is sort of what we need. But you did say that, you know, there are a number of solutions that are coming online. And obviously, there's some high profile ones. You have things like companies like T0 and Templum. And recently, there's a lot of talk about security tokens. And you're saying that probably you threw out more or less a $10 trillion number, which is also a big number that a lot of folks throw out there because gold is more or less a $10 trillion market. So, you know, a lot of the times Bitcoin specifically is sort of measured against that baseline. But you do see that, in your opinion, Eli, that you know, this could probably happen, but you think it's going to happen with security tokens that institutions require are essentially going to go that route.
Yeah, so we are, you know, we're institutional grade broker dealers. So what the lens we use is our institutional grade investors. And from that perspective, the way we look at it is the number of assets include, you know, if you look at real estate, right, tokenized real estate, mm-hmm. you look at commodities, you look at liquid venture capital. So liquid venture capital firms, liquid private equity firms, allows you to have the fluidity and the velocity to trade. And, you know, we believe that everything has to be within the regulatory framework of Securities and Exchange Commission. And we believe that SEC and FINRA are looking at it very carefully to really provide the solutions that the market needs. And, you know, we live in a world where, I mean, Jay Clayton and the SEC is being very involved, and which is really a good thing because they're trying to understand the market. And this is why security token exchange is very important, is because it is an ATS, which is alternative trading systems. And it allows you to do security tokens, which would allow a global measurement of the security token formation. And so that's really what we're looking at.
As far as I understand, and you can correct me if I'm completely wrong on this, one of the reasons we don't really have security token exchanges at the moment is more regulatory than functionally, right? So what are the regulatory hurdles that you and other companies are overcoming? And how are you doing that in order to create these exchanges that are security token focused?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that you have the licensing requirement. The alternative trading systems, the ATS license, is traditionally been used for the cryptocurrency trading and the dark pools. Now, we're using it for the digital asset for security tokens. So the licensing requirements are very strict in terms of being able to trade digital assets in addition to your traditional equity and traditional swaps. But also the KYC, AML, PEP, and then the custody solutions, right? Because an ATS is just an exchange. You need to have the custody solutions on both sides, like you have with NASDAQ. So I think a lot of those solutions are being built and to the point where you have the ability for the SEC and FINRA to be comfortable with the solution. And I think that's really what we're seeing. So it's quite a significant undertaking compared to a digital, you know, exchange that you see. So that's really how we're looking at it.
So essentially, it's just using this ATS license and creating a list of meeting a much more stringent set of requirements that have previously been too much of a hurdle, but are now seen as so valuable that it's something that is going to be more often seen in the future. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that'll be an issue in going forward. I think the issue is once we get started, once the genie is out of the bag, then I think we're going to have a lot of different exchanges. And then, you know, we're hearing that NASDAQ and NYSE are looking at the space as well. So I think what will happen is that the whole future of trading will change. And that's what we're going to see.
Now, do you think the SEC needs to add perhaps a little bit more clarity when classifying tokens? One of our previous guests was pointing out that he didn't see how the SEC could possibly say that something like Ethereum may at one point have been a security token, but it no longer is. What do you think about that? Do you think that they perhaps need to be a little bit more clear, or the industry needs to somehow figure out how to get the word out there of what's a security or what's not? What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think, you know, Ethereum, since it came out, that they're not, that is not a security. But at the same time, you know, it's a new industry. I think SEC is doing a great job in managing it, because keep in mind that the reason the U.S. is the financial capital of the world is because people have trust in the system. Right? I mean, why, if you look at the other markets haven't been able to catch up to the U.S. is because when people invest in the U.S. market, they have the confidence, they have the trust. And the reason why there is trust is because of the enforcement, right? It's basically you have the ability of the SEC to do its job. So I think they're doing a great job in terms of managing the process and really being careful about it. But I think at the same time, you know, you're seeing them open and actively having discussions and dialogue with the industry to understand it. So I think, you know, listen, I mean, people in the industry don't even know what it is. So I think basically have to give SEC time in terms of and work with them to basically have the right optimal outcome for the industry and for the regulators. And at the end of the day, you know, the biggest job we have is to protect the investors. So the framework that we use as broker-dealers is that we want to do the offerings in a way the investors are protected. So that's really the framework we use. And I think SEC is doing the best job it can, given the velocity of changes and, you know, the new instruments that are being coming out in the market. So I think given 6 months, 9 months, I think we'll have a lot more clarity.
Okay.
That's basically what the name of the crypto industry is. It's like, just wait for next year. We're gonna see a lot more developments. It's gonna be way more interesting. But I want the answer now.
Yeah,
that's why we bought you, Eli. We don't wanna wait. Just tell us. Stop keeping it from us.
Yeah.
I know. Wish, but I think overall we know that the industry is getting a lot more mature. We're seeing really good quality teams come out of MIT and different institutions. And the best part is that it is a global market. So the past, as you know, internet was a lot more Silicon Valley. I don't think that is the case anymore. But that has allowed the teams, bright minds, to shine all over the world. And that has been such a refreshing change that that I think only, you know, a decentralized technology like blockchain could have enabled it.
Yeah, it's amazing to see like these teams in a, you know, in Eastern Europe somewhere, like, and not to bash on Eastern Europe, but you know, their reputation is not the same as, say, Silicon Valley, and seeing them have like these big, huge, successful projects on par with something we might see somewhere else, or see countries like Malta being flooded with cryptocurrency companies because of their more lax regulations. You know, you have such an interesting like popping up of areas that a few years ago weren't necessarily getting this kind of funding and technology boosts.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing Bermuda. Bermuda has done a great job in terms of providing the regulatory clarity, and Malta. And then we're seeing different jurisdictions come out. So I think it is happening, and it's a welcome change and a welcome development, I would say. And we're going to see more and more of that. So earlier you mentioned, you know, Eastern Europe. I think some of the brightest minds in the industry are in Eastern Europe. Ukraine is the hotbed for blockchain development.
It's cool to see other parts of the world besides, say, Silicon Valley get the spotlight. So like you said, something so decentralized like blockchain technology allows that kind of thing.
It's worldwide. It's worldwide, definitely.
So we're running low on time, Eli, but is there anything you want to leave the audience with that they absolutely need to know?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I would say, even though it is blockchain and digital assets, but at the end of the day, look at it as you would look at any other investment. Be very careful, understand the people behind it, understand the teams, understand the advisors, understand the regulatory framework. Make sure it is a regulated offering. It is done within the rules and regulations of the jurisdiction that the entity is formed and the offering is being conducted. And lastly, you know, it is something that, you know, only you can tell me as an investor that it is the right opportunity for you. And for the offering, you know, the issuers, I would say that it is a long-term commitment with the investors and with the project. And, you know, really treat your investors and advisors well. And, you know, if any questions, you know, I'm really happy to answer any questions anybody might have. But appreciate the opportunity, guys, and hope that was of some help.
Yeah, I think you clarified a little bit more. I mean, I didn't even know what I kind of knew what a broker-dealer was, but you made it a little more clear. And the role you guys are playing in creating these security sales and things like that. So it's really interesting to hear.
Now, if somebody wanted to reach out and contact you, Eli, how would they go ahead and do that?
I think my email would be probably the best. It's eli@bousted1828.com.
Okay.
Feel free to drop me a line.
And you'll be getting 100,000 messages from people.
Yeah, I was very surprised you gave up your email just like that. But
no, it's gone. Yeah. It's out there.
No worries.
No, but yeah, no. So if somebody, you know, did want to get some, want to talk to you perhaps about an offering or something along those lines, they can talk to somebody who has experience in this field.
Sure, sure. Our email is on our site as well, so it's okay.
Okay, all right.
This isn't his private email.
No. It's you know, we're a regulated entity, so nothing is private. So that's the best part about being a regulated entity. This is transparency. So anyway, so right. Yeah, absolutely. Feel free to drop me a line and love to learn more.
Alrighty. Well, good deal. There you have it. That was Eli Javad Ansari, and thank you for listening to a Bit Cryptic podcast.
Awesome, guys. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thank you for listening to a Bit Cryptic podcast. As a full disclosure, we did receive financial support for this episode. A Bit Cryptic podcast is hosted by Alain Leon, Deng Du, and myself, Jeff Peterson. Show notes are by our editor-in-chief, Deng Du. Show production and editing is done by our miracle maker, Joanna Marie Nicholas. Website is by Sammy Toucan and his team at Pack Surge Media. Remember, nothing we say in this show is meant to be financial advice. If you like this episode, please share it with your friends and family. Thank you for listening, and remember, keep it cryptic.